Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. This is Scott Reich of Crime Talk, and today we have an interview. Our regularly scheduled program will come to you Sunday, because Saturday, tomorrow at 10 a.m. Mountain Time, we're going to go live, and we're captioning this, Ask Scott. Ask me anything. Ask me a question. We'll talk about it, and we'll see what the questions are. Maybe the best question of the day, we'll get a Crime Talk mug. Today, though, we have an interview that we're doing with Jay for Justice. Jay for Justice has her own YouTube channel, and she does a great job. She is a true crime aficionado, and just the other day, literally while she was on the air, she was breaking news. We thought it'd be great to talk with her. She agreed. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Have a great day. We are talking with Jay, and Jay is for Justice is her YouTube channel. Thank you for joining us, taking the time to talk with us.
Hey, thanks for having me, Scott.
No, this is exciting stuff. You're doing good work. Tell me a little bit about your podcast and your channel and how it got started. What got you interested in true crime?
Oh, well, you're going to love to hear this one, but it's Chris Watts. Okay. So it was the Chris Watts case for sure. I think Chris Watts changed the way that we look at crime on social media. I think it was just something we had never seen before. I started out doing a podcast that was just recorded only. I had a partner. Things didn't work out, so I moved on doing my own thing. Started my YouTube channel in early December of 2018.
Okay.
Right around the time when The Discovery came out for Chris Watts.
Yeah.
And it just blew up from there. Like, it was crazy. I think 12,000 subscribers in maybe 2 weeks, if that.
Well, I had a very similar experience. I had done a couple of little, podcasts, didn't really know what to do with it. And a friend of mine said, hey, you should, comment on this Chris Watts case. And I'm like, man, nobody wants to hear what I have to say about anything. And literally, I think one of my videos that took off, I made it. And I look back now and I'm so embarrassed at the quality of it. I was like, oh my God, I can't believe I did that. And I was leaving for vacation and my phone just kept, I get all these notifications. I'm like, what the hell is this? What is going on? And all of a sudden it was all about the Chris Watts. Is this the email that started it all? And
so you
it's just been growing.
Doing YouTube prior to that either?
Not really. I mean, I had kind of some travel blogs. I just thought it was kind of, cool. In my job that I do obviously is, criminal defense. Some days I just want to not think about anything related mm-hmm. to
crime
at all, and something to distract me. And I, started watching videos on YouTube, and I thought, oh, this is kind of cool. And I was going to go on a trip. And so I'm like, oh, I'll just kind of make a little podcast for me and, maybe my kids if they want to watch it or something. And literally a friend of mine said, you should just make a comment. I'm like, what? No one's going to care what I have to say. And bam, there it went.
It's crazy because I've seen a lot of YouTubers that came on the scene during Chris Watts. And with you being one of them, I just remember you coming on the scene and it was like authority, like someone who knows the law is now talking about Chris Watts. So it was like, it's funny how everybody, kind of came together and offered their own little angle to the case,
Yeah. Well, and what was interesting about Chris Watts is literally it's just up the street from, my office.
Right, right. And you were local.
Frederick is right there. I mean, I knew a lot of the players, and it was Colorado law, so I could really kind of anticipate, and I knew, and the one thing I think was kind of interesting was they said, yeah, they set up for a status conference. I remember thinking, well, they're either trying to get a new date without having to go to court, or there's going to be a guilty plea entered, and,
There you had it.
Sure enough, I was right on that one, but, it's interesting. I mean, Chris Watts was a case that so many people want to talk about. Even today, people still want to talk about it. Some people mm-hmm. are like, oh, I don't want to hear another word about Chris Watts.
But they still talk about it too.
But
even
they still,
those people.
But they still watch it because it's so, it is a case that just, I think, captivates so many people. One, because here's a guy who looks like he's kind of living the American dream, yet throw in a little adultery. you throw in this family and a man, you know, somebody that can kill their kids is just people. It's right. unthinkable. People just don't mm-hmm. fathom that.
And the way he disposed of his children too is just.
And the way he disposed of the children was the worst. Mm-hmm. And then I think so many people wanted to see how things shake out in a course of a trial, and we never got that.
We never got it. And now we've gotten all these different confessions and things from him.
Yeah, and it's the kind of thing where, you know, people literally need, you know, closure when you've, you know, somebody sees that, and whether they know the person or not, mm-hmm. it's they need that closure. You know, I've seen it in my own practice over the years where, you know, victims' families, even my clients' families, sometimes they need that closure of what really happened. And right. with a trial, you get a pretty close version of something that happened. And, you know, and I think what a lot of people get wrapped around the axle is sometimes the man admitted to killing his wife and children, an unborn child. You know, does it really matter how or when? You know, was it in the upstairs or was it in the car? People want to know that. But for under the law, it doesn't really matter.
Right, you know? Right. For true crime followers, we want to know every little detail.
Sure.
We want to know what led up to this and what led up to that. But it's a crazy case, I think, because when I first heard they were missing, I started looking at social media and I found Shanann's Facebook, and it was like this encyclopedia of their life. Like there were so many videos and so many pictures. If you felt like you were stepping into their life. And yeah. I think that's what changed it for a lot of people as far as, you know, social media. Chris Watts took social media by storm, I think more so than any other case. But then on the other hand, there's people that I meet that have never heard of it. But those people aren't active on social media.
Yeah. Yeah, so, they're, I mean, that's true. And because, and then I think the social media is the key because, you know, you hear about crime all the time on TV. But literally, you know, like, oh, that's too bad. You see the picture put up on the newscast. But here people could actually go see and listen to Shanann talking about her work, her family, her kids.
The videos of those girls. And
yeah, and whether you liked it or not, that was the reality. I mean, that was it. Yeah. And you could see it and say, yeah, I could be friends with her. Or, you know.
You could relate with them. You know, you could.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, they had everyday issues. I mean, they're trying to put on the, you know, the front that everything's okay. But let's face it, who doesn't know people where you know the ship is absolutely sinking, but everything's fine. Everything's okay here.
Right, right. And I think with her multi-level marketing as well, that was part of the selling aspect of the product she was selling was, you know, if you buy my product, you'll have a life like me. And her life was seemingly perfect. It really was.
Yeah. I mean, that was certainly what she was, you know, trying to portray. And, you know, oftentimes life does not always, social media, you know, that's what they call it, fake book sometimes, is that it.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
So many people these days just.
I think that also the social media has really hindered both families from having any type of closure and moving on. I think that the YouTube, it's been kind of a zoo as far as the two families go, and really putting that division between those families and people that don't even know them are involved, you know, in that divide. It's your team Watts or your team Rusek, and that's it, you know. So that's been kind of, and that bothers me because I really feel like these people really need to have some peace. And I don't know how they'll ever find it with what happened, but I think it's even harder when you have, you know, hundreds of people on a social media platform in the middle of that.
Yeah, and I completely understand, you know, the kind of the true crime where everybody wants to get down to the nittiest details. Mm-hmm. And I've mentioned this on my videos before as well, that you can agree to disagree, but you can do it respectfully. You don't have to call these people names and, oh, they're this and they're that. And say, all right, these are the facts, all right? And what reasonable inferences can be drawn from that evidence or the lack thereof? But it doesn't mean you have to get personal. You know what I mean?
Right.
And, you know, I get I don't know, you probably, people sometimes, you know, you get comments, I get comments.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm, you know, I look at the comments and obviously I like the ones that where people are nice and other people are like, oh my God, your tie sucks. You suck. I think your mouth is dry today. Did you smack your lips? I mean, no matter what you do, somebody is going to be judgmental.
You can't please them all. You can't please them all.
Is going to be judgmental of it. And I get that. But it's the kind of thing where it's like, man, these are just the facts. Let's just talk about it and be polite. We can disagree, but everybody's looking for the same thing, the truth.
Right, right. And for some reason, everybody's really sensitive about this case, right? I mean, we've talked about all these different murderers and the victims, no problem. But everybody's very sensitive of what you say and how you say it when it comes to this case.
Yeah, like you said, it's kind of like people pick sides and that's it.
They've made it personal.
But exactly. And, you know, I mean, the reality of it is the man pled guilty, admitting what he did. And I understand the details and who may or may not have had some participation in it. That'll forever be unknown unless somebody, you know, writes a book or gets an interview with Nicole Kessinger. I'd love to talk with her. I never have. I mean, I've been accused of representing her. I've been, you know, you name it. But it's the kind of thing where I'd love to talk to her and see what really happened.
I think all of us would love to hear that. So get on it.
I've sent a letter to her. She's never responded.
Did you?
Yeah,
really?
I've sent a letter saying, hey.
I don't blame her, though. I mean, I wouldn't want to come out in the public either. A lot of people, I think, criticize her for, you know, going into hiding. But, I mean, I have to say I might do the same thing.
You know, everybody has a story and everybody has a reason for what they do. And their past experiences make them who they are today. And yeah, I mean, who's to say, oh, I would never do that? As I get older, when I was younger, things were always very black and white. This is, you know, this is it. And there's a lot more gray as you get older. And, you know, if she wants, you know, she's probably looking at this and saying, oh, my God, I was dating a killer. What if that had been me? And in the same token, oh, my God, did I set something in motion? I mean, she's got to live with that.
She does.
And maybe, you know, she was, you know, joking. Hey, wouldn't it be great if we just start over? What? I mean, who knows exactly? I mean,
I'm sure
of the conversations.
Everything she said to him, you know, was it something that I said that sent him, you know, to that point, you know, that got him to that breaking point?
Yeah. And, you know, obviously she did not present well in a lot of those interviews, and that didn't help her. She probably had no idea that the DA was going to release the discovery when they did. But I mean, that was couple of the worst interviews I've ever seen, and I've watched and listened to, you know, thousands of witness interviews over the years, and that one just did not come across well for her. And
her demeanor was odd to me. You know, I would have been, if I was being interviewed by the FBI because some guy I was seeing just murdered his family, I would be so scared. She was very, very confident and, you know, had this confident demeanor about her. And that surprised me, actually, because I probably would have been scared, in tears. I don't know. I guess you really don't know until you're in that position.
Yeah. And then the police allowed the dad to be in the interview. I mean,
I was going to ask you about that.
I cannot say I've ever seen that except for maybe a juvenile.
I was going to ask you what you thought about her dad going with her and kind of, you know, butting in. He wasn't just there to hold her hand. He was there trying to control things.
Yeah. And he, for lack of a better term, he did.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I've never seen anything like it. You know, I've been as an attorney like, oh, we'll talk, but I'm going in. Or, you know, if that was my daughter, I would try to do the exact same thing. And they'd probably say, well, no, but we need to listen to what she has to say. And I'd be like, okay, well, then you're not going to talk to me or to my daughter, you know?
Right, right.
So no, I mean, the whole thing is just weird. It's just it's a tragic case, but it's so interesting in the psychological aspects of what brought this guy who really has never been in trouble to just someday, you know, become a mass murderer.
Mm.
It's crazy.
Right. It is. And I have actually spoken to some of the friends of the Watts and also with his sister. And, you know, they all feel the same way. They're in shock still. You know, they can't believe it. It's just sad all around. It really is.
Yeah. And I mean, and my heart goes out to the, you know, the Rusinks. I couldn't imagine having to mm-hmm. bury a child, let alone your grandchildren all at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Watts family, you know, they obviously didn't see it coming. I don't think they said, hey, go home and kill your, I mean,
no.
You know, how did he, and until somebody's been in that situation, you just don't have no idea how you would react. So, I mean, you got to be sympathetic to all sides of this mm-hmm. story. And it's, like I said, we can talk about it. I mean, there's some people out there, I'm sure you shouldn't be talking about this case anymore. Give the family peace.
It's over. It's over.
But yeah. it's also, there's still so many unanswered questions that people would like to know about. I mean,
And as much as Chris has changed his stories or, you know, added things in and omitted things from a previous story, it doesn't matter. Whenever he speaks, people are going to want to hear what he has to say. You know, everybody says, well, I don't believe a word that comes out of his mouth, but you're still going to listen.
Well, exactly. And that was
freaking,
you know, I mean, obviously there was the Cadle Gate where she, you know, there's allegations that she plagiarized and it looks like, you know, it's pretty straightforward. And, you know, we talked to her and the interview was a little weird. Like, why is only half your face there? But the reality of it is that she was one of the few people that actually got to talk with him. And so what he said to her and what she observed, I think was of relevance because people still want to know, like, what made this guy tick and what made him crack?
Right. The only unfortunate thing about Cadlegate is that she had it all in the palm of her hand and she blew it by some really, really silly mistakes, you know? I mean, she had the exclusive of talking to him, writing with him, visiting him, and something as silly as, you know, sources and copying someone else's work, you know, ruined it. That's what's frustrating because I don't know if he'll talk to anybody else again. You know, that might have been a chance that went by the wayside now.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. I mean, I think he's going to be completely suspect of everybody's motives if they are, in fact, writing to him. You know, there's talk that he's got a fan club, so to speak. I'd still, you know, love to talk with him and interview him just to see, you know, but I'd be straight up forward with him. Like, hey, let's talk. Let's just tell it what's the worst going to happen to you? They send you to prison for the rest of your life. I mean, there's not anything you can say.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've had cases where people have done horrible things. And it's so obvious that what was alleged took place, and they'll just deny it to the bitter end.
Mm-hmm.
They'll just like, you know, you can't rationalize with them. Like, it never happened. Well, yeah, it did. It did happen, and this is it. But they won't want to admit, or they want to, you know, for their family or for their own ego, so to speak, they just can't. They won't admit that actually something happened, even though the evidence is right there. And, you know, it's like just tell us what you did. And, you know, I have to believe, you know, pieces have come out. I think it's pretty accurate based upon what he's said and what he told the detectives and the FBI in the subsequent interview when he was in prison. Mm-hmm. But I so wish the judge would have just asked during his guilty plea, tell me in your own words what you did. That would have just
make
summed it up right there.
A little bit.
Summed it up. So
it would have been something. It would have been something.
Yeah.
I have a question for you, actually.
Okay.
Okay. So when this happened, did you ever consider reaching out to Chris and offering up a defense for him?
I can tell you that when I put my channel up, friends of the family contacted me. And at one point, I was contacted by the family. And I didn't go speak with him simply because they did not have the financial resources to do anything. I.e., for representation to pay for it. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I was not going to go interfere in that relationship between him and his other attorneys just so I could say I went to talk with the guy.
Gotcha.
If I had been paid for my services, you know, maybe I would have taken the case. I don't know. Mm-hmm. We'll see. I mean, it never would have happened. You know, frankly.
What if you would have had the case? How do you think it would have went down?
Well, I've expressed this on, you know, some of my videos. I mean, from a defense perspective here in Colorado, the death penalty has not been imposed mm-hmm. nearly. I mean, the guy pled guilty years ago. I think it was the last case, and we haven't executed anybody in forever. It's probably going to get repealed. And the Aurora Theater shooter, who I think was charged with 17 people, couldn't even be executed. So,
It's, you know, not
the whole, oh, we're going to spare your life for under the death penalty, I don't think it was really a threat. And, you know, so at that point, you know, it's, you know, just from, yes, and I've, people always get this word, there's morality and then there's legality. You know, mm-hmm. morally, if the cop pulls you over and says, were you speeding? Yes, your officer, I was. I'm sorry I didn't do it. Okay, morally, you felt great. But guess what? Legally, you just confessed. And, you know, if the officers basically plead guilty or, you know, whatever, I think mm-hmm. when the clients, I mean, I always have to have a conversation with the client and say, the offers plead guilty to the count straight up. Unless they're giving you some sort of concession where, i.e., you're going to get out of prison, let's go to trial. What have we got to lose? Make mm-hmm. them prove their case to each element beyond a reasonable doubt. Or, you know, let's see if we can create issues on appeal. You'd be surprised. Things happen in trial. Witnesses say something. Oh, mistried. Oh, now maybe I get a deal. It goes up. I just had a case we tried 5 years ago. I told the client, he got an unfair trial. Guess what? The Court of Appeals just agreed. Gets a whole, wow. you know, brand new trial.
A whole new trial.
Now, obviously, he had to sit in custody for the last 5 years, but, you know, when they offer
still,
you nothing.
There's a little bit of hope, yeah.
Yeah, when they offer you nothing, okay, game on. Let's go try and do that.
So what do you think his motivation was in pleading guilty? Do you think it was what he said, that he didn't want to put everybody through the trial?
You know,
or himself through the trial?
I think it was a little bit of both. I think mm-hmm. he didn't want, you know, this is a guy, for lack of a better, he looked like he was always a little shy from, you mm-hmm. know, those videos, didn't want to be in the limelight,
quiet.
So to speak. I don't think he wanted to go through it, because then he has to relive it, even though he's probably reliving it every single day of his life.
And he'd be in the spotlight.
He'd be in the spotlight. And then, you know, I guess there's always the risk where people say, hey, you did in fact kill your wife, two daughters and your unborn child. Yeah. You know, Weld County, maybe the jury would have said guilty, but, you know, or given him the death penalty, but I don't know. But I think it was more selfishness on his part. I don't think he mm-hmm. wanted to be in the limelight. I think he wanted to bury his head in the sand and just go away. And if that was enough, you know, because he said in his interview that the attorneys were like, hey, let's go, we'll mount a defense. And he said, no, it's my decision.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yep.
So you know, we'll never know for sure, but
I feel like a trial to him was just too much. It was too much reality for him too. And I think you're totally right about him being shy and not like, you know, he doesn't like being in the limelight like that. You could tell in those videos, he was always just kind of in the background. He was hanging in the background. He wasn't really talking to people. She'd have to tell him, Chris, come talk, you know, come say hi or yeah. whatever.
Which
he
patch
was
are
not
you
willingly in the, you know, he wasn't willingly in the camera like, you know.
Yeah.
Hey, everyone. So,
yeah.
Yeah, I agree with you. That it's interesting though, isn't it?
It is. So you obviously like true crime before the Watts case, but
oh my gosh,
what interests
I've liked
you
it since I was a kid?
What interests you? Is it the mystery? You know, the.
I think it is. I always loved mystery novels when I was a kid. I read a lot as a child, and I loved anything with mysteries.
Yeah.
Figuring things out and you know, going through it, and like you're halfway through the book and you already have it figured out, or you think you have it figured out, you know, and then
but
there might
then
be
you
a
get
twist
to the end.
At the end.
There's
we
a
never
twist.
Know. Yeah. It might be what you thought, or it might be this twist. But The first true crime case that I remember being interested in was the Adam Walsh case.
Oh, yeah. And
because he wasn't that much younger than me. I was born in 73. I don't remember what year he was abducted, but he was around my age. And I remember how scary it was, you know, but on the other token, I wanted to know what happened to him. I wanted to know who did, you know, it was like this intriguing wonder, as well as it was scary because I was a kid, but I love John Walsh. I still just think that man is amazing. And the things that he did after his son's death to, you know, do good and make something positive. And that's what I mean by, you know, these people being involved between the Rusecks and the Watts. And, you know, when you do something positive after something so tragic, you know, you're going to have more peace about yourself. And I think he's a perfect example of that.
Well, absolutely. No, I totally agree with you. And, yeah, that's interesting. I remember as soon as you said the Walsh case, I'm like, yeah, I remember that case. The Adam Walsh. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, you know, it was like one of the first abductions, excuse me. It was one of the first abductions that, you know, I remember. You know, I was in probably elementary school, and it was the strange, you know, they do not talk to strangers, and they were pounding that in our heads at that time. And that was scary, but that was,
yeah,
the
I remember
first
that.
Case
and then,
that,
like, there was the, in Atlanta, all the young kids were disappearing as well.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, those disappearance cases, I mean, you just like, where did they go? What happened?
Yeah, how did they just drop off the face of the earth? And that's a lot of what I focus on my channel. And it was just by accident, is missing people. And a lot of families have come to me, friends of the family, to come on and spread awareness and talk on my podcast about the missing person or persons. And we've gotten tips that have been called in to the FBI after people watching the podcast. And it's amazing. You don't know who you're reaching out there on YouTube.
No, it is amazing. And that's just, you know, the power of the internet that, I mean, it's worldwide. You know, it's no longer, you know, I was growing up, you had the newspaper in town and you had the local television channel and that was it. And now you get the whole world in the palm of your hand on a phone. And like you said, you don't know who's watching. I'm sure you have, you know, subscribers from all over the world that, like, hey,
yeah,
call from Australia, New Zealand.
Analytics, and it's like, whoa, Norway. Like, how do they know about me in Norway? But yeah, it's
yeah. So,
neat.
Never know what could, you know, who knows something or is traveling through. It's like, hey, I remember that, or they see a picture of Timp, and
on several occasions. But the craziest one was actually the Heidi Broussard. That was probably the craziest thing that's ever happened in one of my live streams. Totally unexpected.
Total real time. I mean, that's just...
Total real time. I mean, that live went 5 hours, but I couldn't shut it down. It was like everything just kept unfolding.
Yeah, but that's great. And that's, like I said, I mean, that's the beautiful thing about this is if you think about it, I mean, you were breaking news on a live podcast, you know, in a ongoing, active, missing child, missing person investigation, which ultimately turned out to be, you know, a death investigation, but just you and me, everyday people, just bringing this information out there. I mean, I think it's amazing that you no longer have to have a big television station or an FCC license to start your own radio show.
You can do it right in your living room if you want to.
Exactly.
It's crazy. And I find too that a lot of the major media actually follows a lot. I had media join my Facebook group, my
very
podcast
nice.
Group on Facebook. I had Houston reporters in there. You know, they're kind of looking at us too, because we have all these subscribers that dig, you know, I do. I'm sure you do too.
Oh, I've had, you know, the Doulos
case.
They
email you with all this stuff, right?
Oh yeah. People in the, you know, I've had people say, hey, I live in this neighborhood. Here's photos. Here's the information. You should look into this, look into that. And I mean, it's amazing, the people. And, you know, if you had one investigator, one police investigator working on it, but you have all these other people who, you know, hey, I got 20 minutes of time here, 10 minutes here, and it all kind of comes together. I mean, literally, people are becoming everyday deputized, you know, police officers helping to help solve cases or to clear somebody's name if they've been wrongfully accused, which is just as important.
Absolutely, it is. It is. Back to the interview with Caressa, Heidi's friend. It was crazy how it all started to unfold with just a few questions. If you listen to it and you hear I say, you know, do you recognize this house? Do you recognize these names? We found this baby registry. Do you know who these people are? And she's like, no. And it wasn't until, and people in chat literally had seen the house on the FBI on the while they were raiding, on the news, aerial view. They took to Google, found the house, figured out the address, figured out who owned the house. This is all while I was live. Found out who owned the house, Googled those names, found the baby registry. And then from the baby registry was where we figured out, oh my gosh, this is Megan, Heidi's best friend from camp. Yeah. And everyone, I think, was just like, oh. I remember I gasped. I was like, oh, you know,
yeah.
It was just insane how quick my chat looked up all that stuff. They were just like, boom, boom, boom. Here's this. Here's that. I'm like, wow.
Well, we just did a video. And I don't know if you, have you watched that documentary, you know, Don't F with Cats?
I have.
Same thing. You know, a couple people are just completely outraged that somebody would do this. Let's find out who this guy is and let the truth be told. And it just went here to here to here. And, you know,
it
ultimately.
It's insane to see how they got down to him, you know, and it was all because they didn't like what they saw. They started a Facebook group. Mm-hmm. And all these people started joining it. Okay, I'll help. You know, and they all just got together, same thing, sleuthing, figured it out from one avenue to the next. I mean, they were zooming in on the kid's bedroom, looking at individual items to see what country he was in. And I mean,
because if, you know, if somebody had gone to the police and said, hey, we think somebody, did these terrible things to these cats, the police officer's going to look at it, where do I even begin?
Right.
You may have a detective like, well, it's not in my jurisdiction. I don't have time for this. You know, I'll put it over here on this pile. Maybe they're not, you know, particularly savvy enough on this in the computers to trace and IPs and whatever.
Right.
And he just like, man, I got like all these 10 other cases where somebody's actually deceased or someone's being exploited.
Yeah, they have to put priority on certain cases.
Exactly. Yeah. So these individuals, like I said, you know, they've got their 10 minutes here and then come up with this. And this person has this. They literally create a case file for the police. And, you know, I think everybody's of the mindset that, you know, as long as it's accurate information, you know,
awesome.
So be it.
Yeah.
It's just people got to be careful of speculating and, you know, slandering and, you know, making defamatory comments about people. That's where it gets real. You got to be absolutely sure of it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But it's still so good. And the fact that, like you said, here you are breaking news and your subscribers, you know, are helping to, you know, put all these links together. I mean, that's just the power of the internet. I just think it's absolutely amazing. And
it's crazy. We knew that was Heidi's best friend before the media knew that was Heidi's best friend. Yeah. The media didn't know whose house that was. They didn't know at that time. And I got calls from so many reporters. Because I caught that reaction of her best friend, which was sad, but also just took your breath away when she realized whose house that was. And she insisted, Heidi can't be there. She wouldn't be there. She wouldn't be at Megan's house. It was just all that initial state of confusion caught live. It was insane.
Yeah, I mean, real life unfolding right before your very eyes.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
Go figure. I mean, who would have known? It's kind of luck of the timing. You know, it just all kind of came together at the right time.
Yeah, I'm sure there was some luck involved, but the mere fact of it is you were there on talking about it, making it happen. So, you know, congratulations to you.
Thanks.
That's great.
Thank you.
Is there any new developments on the Heidi Broussard case that, you know, you may have the inside scoop on that we haven't heard about yet?
Not really. I know that everybody's pretty hush hush. The judge sealed the case. I'm sure you know that.
I saw that. And I did see that now they're saying that, you know, Heidi Broussard was strangled.
Yes.
And then, you know, her fiance made that statement yesterday where he said, hey, there's someone else had to be involved. You know, mm-hmm. Heidi could have taken herself. She could have taken, taken her
now,
on.
Now, yeah. And I, you know, I heard him say that. And my thought was this, the only way that I think that if that was true, if, you know, Heidi would have fought her and won, is maybe if Megan had baby Margot and that kept Heidi at bay.
Yeah. Or she was surprised. And, you know, and like I said, I'm mm-hmm. always a little hesitant until I kind of see everything myself yeah. to say this is absolutely the way it's going to happen.
It's the lawyer in you.
It is the absolute skeptic of me, you know, just what I do. I just trust but verify. You know, I just, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. okay. I've just been burned so many times over the years where,
right.
you know, so you always get the client that is emphatic that they didn't do it. It didn't happen. And you're like, wow, this is great. This is great. And then you get the discovery and it's like, where the hell was my client? Because this is not what happened. You know, all these police reports right. are, here's the body cam videos. It's like, this is not even close to what he told me. And then you have other clients like, man, I'm terrible. I just want to plead guilty. I just want to get through this. And you get this like, man, you have a great case. You did nothing wrong. So you kind of just want to see it for yourself. And in today's mm-hmm. world with so much video, whether it's officer-worn body cam videos or surveillance cameras, I mean, I don't know how people these days think they're going to get away with anything.
Anything, I know.
Because if they think a crime occurred someplace, first thing they do is they go and check all the Ring doorbells, right. You know, to see if there's something there. Then they look for security cameras. Oh, we have a car here. Let's zoom in on that license plate. I mean.
Yeah, it's just like the Dulos case where literally the cameras followed him dropping off all those garbage bags.
Yeah. I mean, it's you know, the Dulos case is going to be interesting. I mean, here mm-hmm. you have a guy, kind of an outrageous attorney, throwing out all these theories before he's even seen any of the evidence, you know, against his client. I personally wouldn't do that. But here you have, but you also have a guy with resources, apparently making a $6 million bond.
Right.
He, you know, he can mount a defense. You know, it'll be interesting.
What do you think about his lawyer? His lawyer's involvement and his wife. Did you hear the story about the lawyer's wife?
I haven't heard anything about the lawyer's wife yet.
I just read this last night. The lawyer and his wife were also going through an awful divorce situation.
I take that back. Yes, she had, I think, actually had accused him of like sexual assault or domestic battery.
Spousal rape.
Yes.
Spousal rape. And she got a protection order against him. Mm-hmm. This was, you know, right before, or this was in August of 2018 that went down. End of July, beginning of August of 2018. And then Jennifer went missing in May. Yep. But this woman was saying back in 2018, he wants Sammy killed.
Yeah.
And FOTUS keeps inviting me over to have meetings with, you know, my soon-to-be ex-husband to work, you know, talk things through. And I'm uncomfortable with this.
Yeah.
So
I did see something about that early on when he was arrested that he had had some issues with his wife and cases pending. You know, one thing you never want to do as an attorney is, you know, you can't counsel somebody on how to commit a crime. You cannot participate in anything like that. I mean, this guy. Clearly, he has some issues in his own world going on. But for him to, if the allegations are true, to be involved with a client/friend in the conspiracy so that his friend can kill his wife, allegedly, I mean, that's just crazy. As an attorney, like, that's the last thing this guy he should be doing. I mean,
yeah, and supposedly they were on the phone together while FOTUS was dumping the bags. So he's on the phone with his attorney friend, and he's dumping his wife's or whatever, dumping evidence, and whatever else was in those bags.
But. Well, it also puts it into a weird situation for the attorney because, yes, apparently he's a friend, but if, let's say, hypothetically, Doulos is calling him up and saying, hey, I just, you know, killed my wife, chopped her up into little pieces, and I'm telling you about it. Is that a friend talking or is that a client talking to his attorney? And the attorney can be like, I can't reveal anything. It's attorney-client privilege. And I had case like that once where I had a client that was spending lots of other people's money and he got arrested and his attorney was in the car with him and they were on the way to go, you know, turn himself in, so to speak. And the attorney's like, I'd love to tell you, but I can't talk. It's all attorney-client privilege. And he did the right thing. He got to spend a couple of days in jail for that, but he couldn't talk. So
I feel like they're not attorney-client, though, anymore. When I was reading about the incident with the wife of, what's his name?
Mahini, I think. Yeah.
Hey,
the
Kyle,
attorney.
Cut that part out.
Photo Doulos is old attorney. Friend.
But yeah, I guess around the same time when his wife was accusing him of the spousal rape and getting the protection order, right around that same exact time frame was when he dropped Fotis as a client in the case against him with Gloria Farber, Jennifer's mother.
Correct.
So he dropped him as a client in that case. So would that make him just a friend from that point forward?
No, the attorney-client privilege continues on. And if the client calls you back up for even a little bit of advice and says, hey, let me tell you where the body's buried, he can't reveal that without.
Wow. Okay. I didn't know. I didn't know how that worked.
Yeah, no, the attorney-client privilege is sacred. You can't talk about it. So he could be in a real position. And I think he's the one that's still in custody. He hadn't made bond, I think.
No, he's the only one that didn't get out.
Yeah.
He's the only one. It was $420,000 he was going to have to cough up to get out, and he didn't do it.
Yeah, he's not having a good day. He's probably wondering where his buddy, Fotos is right now.
Right. Left him in the dust. But you asked, I want to go back to the Heidi case for a second, because you asked if there was any new developments, and something just popped in my head that I've talked to somebody who knows one of her siblings very well.
Okay.
And Megan, from what I've been told, is swearing that this baby is in fact hers, and this is a huge mistake. So she's insisting this child is hers. She's telling her mom it's all going to get worked out. It's fine. The mom's kind of buying that right now.
Yeah. I don't know. This is speculation, but I'm going to tell you it's completely speculation. I think that Megan Firamuska, that she's got some delusional type of issues where she probably believes it's absolutely true, but it's not accurate in reality, but they're going to believe it till the bitter end, so to speak. And I can't remember. We just had a client where very similar type of thing. I can't remember the exact diagnosis, some sort of delusional disorder, but there was a much fancier name that I can't recall right now where, you know, they think this is the absolute truth and everybody's out to get me and et cetera. So it's,
they really truly believe their own stories.
Exactly, because they've created it in their mind and they've rationalized everything up to that point where there's just a big mistake. It'll all be worked out. And I guarantee you they've done the DNA evidence. You know, I know a lot of people are wondering why has it not been charged as a murder yet? And they're, you know, they have plenty of time. She's in custody. She's not going anywhere. Let the district attorney do their investigation and they'll charge her, you know. There's no statute of limitations in most jurisdictions on murder.
So you think they're just finishing up their investigation and then the charges will come?
Yes.
Because everybody's freaking out about the no murder. Why hasn't she been charged with murder? Then they're saying there was possibly another person in the car with Megan, you know, due to the eyewitness, I think, saw someone get out of the passengers and open the back door for Heidi and the baby to get in.
Yeah.
And then got back into the passenger side. I mean, eyewitnesses can be wrong.
Yeah, you know, obviously video's better if it hasn't been altered or any.
Do you know if they have video of that? Because I never caught if they did or didn't.
I don't think it's video, and my recollection was it was a neighbor that recalls.
That's what I thought.
Somebody come outside. You know, but people's memory. Some people remember lots of things, but at the time, well, was it important? Well, how is it so important now? You know, are they looking for their 15 minutes of fame, or do they really have, you know, legitimate information? Who knows?
I would be a terrible eyewitness, Scott. I forget everything.
Most people are.
You would think, like, if I follow true crime, I'd have it in my brain, you know, like, oh, look at that license plate, or remember this, or I would be horrible.
You know, most people are. If you look at, you know, there's studies where, you know, people say, you know, something happens, you know, pick out the person that did it. And they're even like focusing, like they know they're part of a study. They can't do it. That's why eyewitness identification is really very unreliable. Mm-hmm. Then you throw in a gun. There's a thing called gun focus where people aren't looking at the person that's holding the gun at them. They're looking at the firearm to see, oh my gosh, is something bad going to happen?
Right. That makes sense.
I mean, yeah, eyewitness identification stuff is probably the most unreliable identification. If you look at the most wrongful conviction cases, it's usually faulty forensic evidence. You know, oh, it was a hair fiber and it turns out to be a dog hair or something like that. Mm-hmm. Or eyewitness identification. It's unreliable. Not all the time, but it can be. It can be because people become convinced.
Well, if you take that coupled with what Shane said, do you think it's a little bit more likely that he believes she couldn't have done it alone? Then we have the eyewitness account. Do you think it's a little more probable that there was a second person?
It would have been easier with a second person, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. But at this point, other than someone recalling that there was somebody else in a car, you know, it could have been, I mean, who knows, a friend or whatever, but they were dropped off later or beforehand or whatever, before anything bad happened. So maybe that person was in the car, not saying they are, but got out before anything happened, had no clue. You know, the guy that lived with Megan Fieramusca, he's like, well, I thought it was my kid and she said she was pregnant, but I guess come to think of it, I never saw her bare belly. Which is weird because I remember when my wife was pregnant, you were always kind of, ooh, let me see the belly. Ooh, let me feel the belly.
Yeah, and you can feel the kicks and things like that.
Yeah. So that's a little weird. I mean, these cases are weird. And we had a case here in Boulder, Colorado, a couple of years ago. And I knew one of the, I was talking to one of the public defenders that represented the lady, but she put an ad on Craigslist saying that she was selling new baby clothes. And, you know, anyone who's ever had a kid knows you can get some great baby clothes bargains because, you know, they grow out of them so quick they still have the tags on.
Right.
So the lady goes over there. Lady stabs her, removes the child from her stomach wound, basically leaves her to die in the bathroom in the basement of her house, and literally like, oh, look at my baby. You know, I mean, and the lady survived, thank goodness, but, you know, she's had the child ultimately died. She died. I mean, it was just horrific. Mm-hmm. And you just, and people, there's something mentally not right where they think that they can do that.
And that's what I was kind of, you know, talking about on my podcast was, did Megan, was she pregnant at one time and lost the baby? And, you know, that's what kind of pushed her in this direction to take Heidi's baby. Who knows? But a lot of women who either can't have children or lose children seems like they are the ones that tend to steal babies. The case in Chicago that happened last year, the girl that went, it was the same thing, Facebook Marketplace, went to the house to do a meetup. She went missing. I don't know if the baby died or not, but she did. She did. She was found. But it's just, it's crazy. But to think that your best friend of 24 years has done this to you, you know, has done this, that's what makes this just really mind blowing.
It is. And you know, to and for the means of taking a child because you think that you're pregnant or you want to be pregnant, maybe you've lost a child, and to just be like, oh, I'm just going to take this child, everything's going to be okay, everything's fine.
Like, right. What? I mean, and she had Heidi in the trunk, and they could smell the decomp right when they got on the property that night.
Yeah.
So while we were live, right, the FBI and the all of the police that were there could smell decomp. And what was she going to do? Like, what was she thinking? She could just but what gets me is the guy that lived with her, didn't he smell it?
Exactly. And but it goes back to that kind of that delusional psychosis that these people are in. Like, I have no idea what you're talking about. There's a body in my car. I have no idea.
Right.
Everything's
fine.
Like
a
I'm just here taking care of my little baby. And they're in a completely different world. And it's hard to explain. I mean,
it is. It's sad. It's disgusting, but it's intriguing all the same.
Yeah. You know, I'm sure the prosecution is doing what they can in their investigation to figure out what exactly happened or where it happened and see if there was anyone else involved. And like I said, she's in custody. She's not going anywhere. Do your investigation, dot all your I's, cross your T's, then indict her, then charge her. You know, don't rush it. You know, that's one of the things that's so much different in state court versus like a federal court case. Federal cases, they build them cases for years, whether it's bringing down a drug organization, organized crime, you know, someone taxes or whatever, they dollarize, then they go to the grand jury and indict. And, you know, their conviction rate is like 99%. The state courts, you know, like, ooh, we just tripped over a body. I guess we should figure out how to do that. You know,
we have to, yeah, we have to get, hold someone responsible. Right.
And if we arrest somebody, we've got to charge them usually within a very short period of time because we can't just throw people in jail and conduct our investigation for the next 2 years. So it's got to be quick, or let them go and then come back and do it later. But as you know, any crime scene goes, the longer things go by, evidence is destroyed, it disappears, witnesses' memories fade.
People forget.
So that, you know, they have to act, you know, very quickly. And that's why in federal cases, they always try to make most of their witnesses federal agents who observed this and saw this because they know they're going to be around versus the guy that's like, you know, transient that's not going to be there for trial.
Right.
So it's, yeah. The Broussard case, I think, is going to be very interesting. She's obviously, the prosecution's doing their job. I'm sure her attorneys that have been appointed for her, they've been, I think she has a public defender.
She does.
I'm sure the first thing they're doing is having her comped or sending in some sort of psychiatrist to evaluate her and see, you know, is she even competent to proceed? You know, does she really understand what's going on here? Does she appreciate the charges, that kind of thing? And if she doesn't, she could be potentially not competent to proceed.
And that doesn't happen too often, does it?
It happens more often than people can possibly imagine.
Really?
There are so many people in the criminal justice system with mental health issues.
Right.
It is, I think most people would be shocked by it. And, you know, most of the clients that, or people that you see in court that, you know, there's competency issues, you know, for lack of a better term, they're probably, you know, they're indigent, they're possibly homeless, they're not on medications, things like that. But it happens all the time. We had a client once where it took him 4 years from the time that we said, hey, we don't think he's competent, to restore him back to competency, to say, okay, now we can finally proceed with your case. It is much more frequent than anyone could possibly imagine. I couldn't give you a statistic off the top of my head, but
yeah, I just, you know, I remember I followed the Andrea Yates case, and she was found not competent.
Yeah.
And that was one of the first, like, you know, high profile cases that I had seen where, you know, the person was found not competent.
Yeah. And people being found not competent happens quite a bit. And usually somebody has a history of, you know, schizophrenia or some sort of delusional disorder, something along those lines, but they just can't appreciate what's going on. Mm-hmm. You can't understand who the players are in the courtroom, the prosecutor, the judge, defense attorney. What are they supposed to do? Most right. people generally can get that. And my general experience as well, it's the client's like, the voices are talking. I'm not sure. I'm questioning my competency. Like, oh, really? You know, it's like, as an officer of the court, I can't just raise that. I have to have a good faith basis for it. My experience,
though,
is... That
sounds good, but...
My experience is, you know, when someone's truly incompetent, when they're just completely out there and they become very upset that you're even raising the issue, how dare you say that I'm not competent, and they don't want to go. The guys that are malingering mm-hmm. are usually the guys like, oh, send me to the state hospital. I think the voices have told me it's, you know.
Right, right.
And they're just malingering, you know, trying to delay the process. The truly crazy ones, are they're like, I'm nothing wrong with me. I'm completely fine. Everyone, mm-hmm. how dare you accuse me of this?
And that's my baby.
How dare right? you accuse me of this? Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I bet if people look back, they'll probably look and say, ooh, I guess we probably noticed that before, but they can function in the world. I mean, they really can. A lot of people that yeah. are not competent in court can function in the world. It's not just, you know, the homeless guy that you see in the corner, you know, talking to himself or not, you know, talking to his right. imaginary friend, so to speak, that he truly believes is there. There are lots of people, everyday people. Yeah. That,
I mean, obviously, I mean, Megan kept Heidi as a friend for 24 years.
Yeah.
You know, 24 years.
Yeah, they can fake it. They can, you know, they're intelligent enough. I mean, a lot of the people are very smart, intelligent, but, you know, mental health issues are such a big deal.
It's just not right,
mm-hmm. in the criminal justice system. It's astounding. I mean, I couldn't give you an exact number, but I'd say 85% maybe of my clients, usually there's some sort of mental
there's
health.
There's something wrong. Yeah, something wrong mentally.
Bipolar, whether it's diagnosed, undiagnosed. Oh, it's undiagnosed. So then they use drugs and alcohol to self-medicate, mm-hmm. and they, you know, to try to level
then
them out.
Then they end up doing,
Then they go steal to get the drugs to self-medicate, but they can't keep a job.
And now they're in the system.
It just keeps going and going and going, you know.
Now, you know, it's kind of a little off topic from what, you know, we originally were talking about were the cases, but what is your opinion on the mental health treatment in prisons? You know, and also another question, when your clients are not mentally capable of standing trial, where do they go?
Good, interesting question. So, you know, everybody thinks, you know, when they hear somebody's not competent, like, ooh, they're going to get off. No, they don't. They're going to be evaluated. If, you know, psychiatrist says they're not competent, proceed. They have to see if they can restore them. And so they go off to usually to the state mental hospital, and there's a time. They're not going to just release somebody. Oh, you know, the crime that you're facing can carry up to 6 years in prison, so we're going to treat you for 6 years and kick you out. They'll just keep extending it. And they'll see if they can get restored, usually through medications. Same thing if somebody said, oh, not guilty by reason of insanity. He was found not guilty by reason of insanity. Oh, my God, that's terrible. He walks. No. All that means is saying you did the act, but your mind wasn't there. So guess what? We're going to go send you to the mental hospital and we'll evaluate, you know, once again, let's say it's whether it's life or max penalty is 6 years, they can keep them for that long to try and restore them back to a functioning member of society.
And then they would move them to prison from there or they would stay in
the hospital. They would stay there in the mental institution. And what's the classic case is... oh my gosh, the name's escaped me. The guy that shot President Reagan years ago. Why can't I think of his name? It'll
Is
come
it
to
Chris,
me.
Chris something?
I don't know. I can't remember off the top of my head. But, you know, he shoots the president. You know, he's has... Mm-hmm. What's John Hinckley Jr. There it is. John Hinckley Jr. You know, he shoots President Reagan. He's basically found... Oh.
What happened?
I don't know.
Uh-oh.
Pause. Oh, maybe there we go.
That was me. Sorry.
Okay. So we have, you know, John Hinckley Jr. shoots President Reagan. He's found to be, you know, basically not guilty by insanity. They ship mm-hmm. him off to the mental institution. And here they are some 30 years later. They're like, hey, we think we've got him back to being fixed. We're going to allow him to go home and see his family on the weekends or, you know, to get more and more time. Can he actually go back into society? Yeah. So they really monitor him. It's not a free pass, which is what a lot of people
think. If they get off on insanity, then they're free and clear.
Exactly. They're like, oh, you're just having a bad day. No, you're going to the mental institution forever. So
the goal is with those criminals is to get them to where they can comprehend and
yeah,
go from there with their punishment, that they understand it.
Correct. I mean, think about it. It would be unfair. If somebody's not competent to proceed, it's just inherently unfair. I mean, you mm-hmm. want somebody to understand what's going on. It's called due process. You want to make sure they understand what's going on in the courtroom today. Do you understand and appreciate it? And are there people that malinger like, oh, I don't understand. I'm crazy.
Yeah, right, right.
Those are easy to see through.
The ones that truly don't understand.
And if you've ever dealt with someone or had interaction with somebody that's truly schizophrenic, mm-hmm. has real severe mental issues, it's pretty obvious.
You can tell. Yeah, you can tell they're not faking it.
Yeah. I mean, they truly believe what's taking place.
Delusional.
Yeah.
Truly delusional.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think you're right. I think that's Megan 100%.
Yeah. And I don't know 100%. If she's. Yeah, my guess is the first thing that's gonna come up is they're gonna request a competency evaluation, or the defense is already getting one done, and they're gonna say she's not competent to proceed at this point. That's my thinking, but mm-hmm. we'll just have to wait and see. I wish I had a crystal ball; it would make it a lot easier.
Well, she sure was making a lot of phone calls during that week that Heidi was missing. She was calling Caressa 4 or 5 times a day to find out if there was any updates. She called Tim Miller from Texas Equisearch, mm-hmm. talked to him for 45 minutes. You know, is there anything I can do to help? Call me if you need anything. I mean, just, wow. I mean, that's totally delusional, right?
Trying to create that, oh my gosh, my friend, even though she's mm-hmm. the one that allegedly did bad things to her and has her stuffed in her car, like,
mm-hmm. It'll be interesting to watch this one unfold for sure.
It will be. Are there any other cases mm-hmm. that you're really watching right now?
Nope, just Dulos. Well, that's enough. That is a lot on my plate right now. The Dulos, the Heidi case, and of course, I'm always open when something comes up with Chris Watts.
Absolutely. Do you? You said you had a lot of people from the news media following you right now. Is there anyone out there that you really trust when it comes to, you know, journalists? In the media?
No, it's also new to me. I don't know. It's also new to me. I got all these. I had Inside Edition. I did an interview with them. I had ABC that, you know, had me sign off that my podcast footage could be used at all at ABC affiliates nationwide. I was like, what? What's going on here? Well, you know, so time. It was, yeah, that was all just by surprise to me. And no, I mean, I don't know any of them well enough to say that, but I would like to.
Are you going to have a friend like back to. On again?
Yes. Yes. If she's willing to, I know she said she would. We've kept in touch. One of my, my helpers on the podcast was the one that initially reached out to Caressa from a Facebook group. That was how we got in contact with her. And she set that up, the interview, and they've continued to keep in touch. You know, every few days or so, she checks to see how Chris is doing. And, you know, she's obviously struggling, but she said that she would at some point in time.
Well, that's good. I was watching one of your videos and your mods were saying, you know, how they met you. And they're like, the worst thing about being a mod is all the drama.
They all said the same thing.
Yeah.
It's
funny. I mean, you know, you've seen comments where people just go back and forth of, you're right. Oh, you're a terrible brutal. Human being. Blah, blah. And it's just like, people, can't they're we just brutal. Be nice? I mean, we can agree to disagree. Just present it the facts. Here's the facts.
Yeah.
Not speculation. Yeah. We can sit and speculate all day long. But until we actually hear from witnesses, see facts, see reports where people have said, this is what I saw and observed, you know, it's just speculation. And guess what? Speculation is not admitted in a court of law.
See, I like to speculate. But I'm not a lawyer like you.
I know, but a lot of people do. But, you know, my job is...
You have to be very careful. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, and whether I'm defending somebody or let's say, you know, I'm plaintiff. I'm suing on behalf of somebody. You know, the first question is, how do I prove it? Okay. It's one thing to say that person, you know, wronged me. Okay. But I need evidence. What happened? What was the... You can't just
say
it has. That's
the first question you go back to in your mind. How can I prove it?
How can you prove it?
That's the first thing you think of.
Yeah. What evidence is there? What witness, what document can I present to say that something happened? Now, you know, a witness can only testify in court as to what they saw, what they heard, what they said. Sometimes what somebody else said to them to show the impact that it had on them, but witnesses can't testify as to what somebody else told them. You have to bring in that witness to say, I told this other person. And so, you know, that's why cases are really, they're hard to prosecute because you need to get all those witnesses. And usually in, you know, true crime type stuff, a lot of those witnesses are sketchy, transient, and it's literally like herding cats, you know, trying to find it. I remember when I was a prosecutor in the, Marine Corps, I was stationed at Parris Island. And when, you know, if a crime was committed and it was like, say, against a drill instructor or a drill instructor versus a young Marine, well, at graduation, all those Marines scatter all over the United States and all over the world. And you had to try to find them to get them orders. And that was easy because you could just say the Marine Corps, order them back. But in the civilian world, if they've moved out of state, it's a pain in the butt to get somebody served when they are no longer in the state of Colorado or in the state that
you got
to
track them down and
you got to get the, if they won't accept service and offer to pay for them to come back, you got to go to a judge in that state to order them into court. And it's a pain.
It sounds like
it's really, it's a difficult. So, I mean, so prosecutors have a tough job, you know, cause they gotta, like I said, it's not what they think happened. It's what can they prove?
They have to prove that it happened.
Exactly. And that's why everybody's always like, oh, so-and-so got off so easy. Well, it depends. Maybe witnesses disappeared. Maybe they didn't cooperate. You know, their memory's fading. Oh, I don't remember that. I mean, there's so many things that...
Because it's not your job as a defense attorney to prove that your client's innocent.
Correct.
It's the job of the prosecutor to prove that they did whatever they're charged with.
Exactly. And as more time goes by, the more difficult it becomes. You know, like I said, witnesses die, you know, whatever that person was going to say, not coming into evidence anymore. You know, like these old cold cases. I mean, those are hard cases to prove unless
people aren't even around anymore, right?
Exactly. Unless you can bring, you know, the DNA evidence in. And I did a homicide about 5 years ago. It was a cold case and it was almost 20 years old at that time. You know, and trying to get the people who collected the evidence. You know, these detectives have been retired for 10 years.
Oh,
and,
my gosh.
Yeah, I don't remember that, but what does the report say? Let me, I guess that refreshes my memory. And, you know.
It's virtually impossible then, yeah. Huh?
But, you know, when they have new evidence that comes in via, i.e. DNA, they can retest it and say, oh, now they have somebody live that can then do it. And they don't necessarily have to worry. They get new samples because the people that did the original samples are gone.
Long gone.
Or didn't exist, so.
Cold cases are pretty fascinating, too, to me, the old ones.
They are. And I think the big area that is to watch are all these DNA sites, you know, the whole 23andMe, where police officers are given access to these databases and they find a DNA profile that's close. And then they see if it's somehow related to a suspect that's... you know, or related to that individual that may be a suspect in a cold case. And then they go get his beard. I think I just saw one where I can't remember if it was here or in it was Colorado or somewhere where the guy was arrested in Florida and the police were looking for the whole 23andMe. They found his like brother or cousin. They look at him and say, well, you know, he was here. They retrieved a beer bottle from a bar that he was at. They watched him. Got his DNA from that, tested it, and it tested you know, to this case, to a murder case like 30, 40 years ago. Yeah, it was here in Colorado. And, you know, that's where it's going to be, because unless you've been in the criminal justice system, you were in the military, a lot of people aren't in DNA databases. So when they expand these 23andMe's where they can put all that data into these other sources to compare these DNA profiles to, it's going to open up a whole new opportunity for the police to solve cold cases.
Which is really awesome.
No, it's great awesome. Because people need justice. I mean, people need closure. I mean, I think that's the biggest thing with somebody's an unsolved case is they closure. Like, you know, who did it? Are they around the corner? Are they still here? Are they still doing it?
Right. Are they still in the area? Are they dead? Are they in prison? I mean.
Yeah. You know, did you see the case about the guy in Texas? They say he's probably the most prolific serial killer ever. And it's a guy that has, he was serving a life sentence in California for murder. And then Texas got him for a bunch of cases. And he's given meticulous detail of all these people that he had killed. And usually it was, you know, prostitutes and things like that. But he's providing all this information. I think, I mean, I think they estimate it could be close to 100 people. And I've seen a little bit of news on it. I think we actually did a show just briefly on it.
But nobody's really talking about that, but not any details. But that's,
you know, but people. But the DNA, you know, I mean, that's the huge part about it is the DNA is that it never goes away. Hey, God, where's did I? Hold on a second. That book, did I put it in here?
The Murders in the Bank Vault?
Yeah.
I think it's a living office.
Yeah. There's this great quote. Kyle's going to run and grab this book. And it was in a book here. It was a local attorney wrote a book about a bank robbery murder that happened, I think it was early 90s, where literally it was a Sunday morning. I think it was Father's Day, where somebody came into the United Bank building. It's a big, tall building downtown, you know, like 55 stories. But in the basement, there's all the bank vaults and security guards and things to get past. And somebody went in, shot three security officers there and took off with an undisclosed amount of money, big money. The prime suspect was a guy that was a security guard there who was a former police officer and kind of got away with it. And a legendary attorney here in the state of Colorado was the attorney, a guy by, an attorney by the name of Walter Garash. Just a great guy. I've met him, had cases with him. Just a great attorney. Anyway, he and another great attorney in his office by the name of Scott Robinson walked the guy. It was a death penalty case, walked him. Anyway, he wrote a book after it. And probably one of the best quotes, and I always use this, I usually put it on a board or something in a case where there is no DNA evidence or no physical evidence tying my client to it. But I think this sums it up. It says, wherever the criminal steps, whatever he touches, whatever he leaves, even unconsciously, will serve as silent witness against him. Not only his fingerprints or his footprints, but his hair, the fibers from his clothes, the glass he breaks, the marks he leaves, the paint he scratches, the blood he deposits or collects, all of these and much more bear mute witness against him. This evidence does not forget. It is not confused by the excitement of the moment. It is not absent because human witnesses are. It cannot perjure itself. It cannot be prejudiced by, it cannot be influenced by suggestion, by falsely reinforced identity. It cannot be wholly absent. Only human failure to find it, study it, and understand it can diminish its value. I mean, I think that's
100%, right?
DNA evidence, right? It is what it is.
It is what it is. You can't dispute it.
You can't say, your memory's not very good. Your eyesight's bad. It's there. Now, how it got there, was it consensually? Was it transferred? There's other issues you can get into, but I just think that quote
sums it up.
And it's such great corroboration that somebody says you did something, and oh, guess what? We just happened to find your DNA there. you know? Mm-hmm. And when I first started practicing,
like the Doulos case,
exactly.
All the DNA they found.
Yeah. You know, he's going to have some splaining to do how his DNA and fingerprints got over these trash bags.
And the
bags.
Girlfriend's DNA was also in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's going to be his biggest problem, because when I first started practicing law, DNA was new and courts were still undecided. You had to have hearings on it to decide if there was sufficient scientific reliability. Now the courts have broadly accepted it. I mean, DNA is like comes in and they give you these huge numbers. This DNA is a match, and if it were to be someone other than the defendant, it would be 1 in 656 quadrillion, you know, that's like 20 zeros or something.
Right. Undeniable.
Yeah. It's like, it's undeniable. And then the only thing you say, well, yeah, of course my DNA would be there. It was consensual, you know?
Yeah.
That's what it boils down to. So it's interesting. And
It is. I could pick your brain all day long, Scott.
Yeah. I enjoy talking to you. It's great. I'm sure you have tons of other things to do.
Oh, I'm sure you do. You're the lawyer here.
It has been a long week.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me on.
No, I appreciate you taking the time, and you know, really enjoy it. I enjoy your podcast, and you know, Kyle told me about it, that you know, you like, man, she was on the news because she was breaking news at the time. I'm like, how cool is that? So
I used to watch you a lot when you'd go live. Was it like on Saturdays you'd go live?
Yeah. Yeah,
and you talk about Chris Watts,
yeah.
And I remember it was probably back in like the early spring. I came into one of your live chats, and I asked you something, and you saw my name, and you said Jay for Justice. You were like, "I've heard of his podcast."
Sorry about that.
No, it's fine.
It's a her.
There's a lot of people who've done it, but all these people in chat were like, "Jay's a woman. Jay's a woman." But I don't think you were, you know, obviously following.
No disrespect intended, I'm sure.
Oh no, none taken at all. It was actually kind of funny. I wanted to bring it up.